everybody. Hello, thinking, caring people. Thank you for joining me today. I am Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. Today, I'm dedicating this show to activism. Now, I've been doing this show for over 10 years, and it is all about activism, food activism. But specifically, I wanted to dedicate it in memory of two wonderful activists, two wonderful people who unfortunately died this past week. I'm getting a little choked up just talking about it. But I want to put this out there. David Emanuel was a wonderful person. I met him about 6 years ago. And what I remember about him was his bright eyes, his big smile, his great laugh. And he was very passionate about food and food, feeding the hungry and eliminating food waste. And he spent a lot of time with freeganism, retrieving and saving so much food that's wasted, good food, and making sure that it was given to those who needed it. So we'll miss you, David. And I also want to dedicate this program to Susan Weingartner. I met Susan in the 90s. She was one of the founders of Earth Save Los Angeles, and I met her at a number of events, and I just loved her enthusiasm, her energy, and also a great smile and really a caring activist. And she went on to do lots of wonderful things. She was a photographer and most recently the director of events for Mercy for Animals. And for the last 3 years, she was fighting lung cancer. And I got to connect with her numerous times. And I really thought she'd make it. So just sending some love out to the universe and grateful that these two people walked the planet, David Emanuel and Susan Weingartner. And now that they're gone, we all need to work a little extra harder to support their dreams as well as our own. Okay, we have two phenomenal guests today, and I want to bring on my first guest. I cannot wait to start talking about this topic and speaking with Zen Honeycutt. First and foremost, a mom. I'm going to read her whole bio. It's amazing. She is also an activist, speaker, author, founding executive director of Moms Across America, and co-creator of Mothers Across the World with Dr. Vandana Shiva. While heading Moms Across America, Zen initiated the first testing for glyphosate in tap water, breast milk, and urine, and spearheaded the nonprofit's successful petition to Costco to remove Roundup from their shelves. Happy to speak to anyone interested in better health for all. She has been featured on ABC, CNN, The Dr. Oz Show, The Wall Street Journal, C-SPAN, Fox News, Reuters, Huffington Post, and many other media outlets. Her documentary, Community Rising, highlights efforts across our nation to transform the food supply, and she is the author of Unstoppable, Transforming Sickness and Struggle into Triumph, Empowerment, and a Celebration of Community. So let's bring on Zen Honeycutt. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Karen, and thank you for all your listeners for their time. Thank you.
Well, the first thing I want to do is I want to say that I'm sorry that you had to write this book, Unstoppable, and that you had to write and that you had to found Moms Across America. I'm sure a lot of wonderful things have come out of it, and I'm really grateful that you're doing this wonderful work, and you've probably developed some incredible skills and have become an even more wonderful person. But the fact that our food system is a disaster is a disaster.
Yes, it was not something I ever intended on doing. I thought activists wore too much patchouli and had too much time on their hands and were just outright annoying. I just had no interest in ever being an activist. And then my children got sick, and I did not know what was going on. And slowly over time, once I began to find out about the food supply, I thought, wait a second, I need to do something about this. First for my children and my family, and then when I saw the difference that was made in their lives and their behavior and their learning and their health, I thought, wait a second, it's not enough just for my family to eat organic and for them to get better. their future spouses, I have three boys, their future spouses are out there someday, you know, somewhere. And someday I hope that they could get married. And if they want to procreate and have children, I would like them to be able to do that. And when I learned about what was in the food supply, I thought, wait a second, what's happening with the toxins and the GMOs in the food supply could impinge upon their ability to actually be, you know, to be able to procreate. And so I knew that this was not just my family issue. This is a community issue, and took on the initiative to create Moms Across America and a nationwide movement with the support of many amazing people who are very passionate and creative and committed, much like it sounds like your friends. And I'm very sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
This is exactly why we do what we're doing. There's too many of us that are getting sick and are being affected by the toxins in our environment, and it has to stop.
It has to stop, and it is all about the community. What surprises me is that those who are in power, they have families, they have children, I assume, care about their health. And yet many of them knowingly know that they're putting toxins out in the world for their families and our families. And I know I loved reading your book, Unstoppable. I was riveted. It was just fascinating from cover to cover.
Thank you.
Loved how courageous you have been speaking at the meeting, the shareholders meeting. For Monsanto.
Yes.
Oh, please.
Yeah.
I mean, that's amazing. And looking into the CEO's eyes and having your conversation, your back to back. And that was really wonderful. But how does that person sleep at night?
Yeah, that is a good question. There is a fine line in between being ignorant and, you know, really just not knowing the impact of what they're doing and being essentially evil. You know, my mother really did teach me not to see anybody as evil, to find the good in everyone. Mm-hmm. But I was particularly challenged with the CEO of Monsanto. The only thing that I could do when I met him was to really implore that he do the right thing, right? That to see him as bigger. And that's why I said to him, we look forward to the day when Monsanto creates products which are no longer harming our children. And when he claimed that he wasn't, you know, harming our children, long story short, I said that, well, you know, it takes a big man to make a big and powerful company, but it takes an even bigger man to acknowledge when something's not working and to go in a new direction. And so whether he knew or not what he was actually causing, there would need to be a point when he would either take in a new direction or not. And I think what happened was that he saw that they were in too deep with Roundup and the harm that they were causing. And that's why he sold off the company to Bayer, and he got out, and he, I'm sure, got him, you know, tens of millions of dollars balloon check and is living just fine right now, while millions of other people are impacted by the poisons that he put out into the universe.
Let's talk about glyphosate.
Yes.
Where do we begin? So we've talked about it numerous times on this program, but you did some novel things. So glyphosate, of course, is the main ingredient that we find in Roundup, and there are numerous Roundup ready crops, soy and alfalfa and cotton, and that are designed to resist the poison that's in Roundup so that it can kill the weeds. And the weeds, of course, are really smart, and they're becoming bigger and resistant, so we have to add more of the toxin. Glyphosate has been shown as safe by some. It's been shown as a carcinogenic to those I trust. And it's everywhere now. And you have done tests to show where we can find it.
Yes, and this was actually inspired by by what most people would call the opposition. I was watching a panel with the Heritage Foundation, which is a GMO. It was a GMO promoting a panel. And one of the women on the panel said, you know, the industry's biggest problem, that's the GMO industry's biggest problem, are these mom bloggers who are saying that their children are getting better when they get off GMOs and eat organic. And she was essentially talking about me. And she said, and many of our moms, right? And she said, and they have no evidence. They are perpetuating a fraud on the American people. And so I thought, no evidence, no evidence. Ding, we need to get evidence.
Mm-hmm.
And so I realized that testing for GMOs would be quite complicated because that's a very technical thing. But testing for glyphosate, which 80% of GMOs are engineered to withstand glyphosate, that's the declared active chemical ingredient in Roundup and 750 other glyphosate-based herbicides like Ranger Pro and Ranger Max and things like that. And this is a common weed killer, you know, used, the most common weed killer in the world, actually used in our backyards. But a lot of people still don't know it's used directly on our food supply. And it was originally used on our food supply because when they declared war on bugs and weeds after World War II, you know, the chemical companies needed a new market for their chemicals. They convinced the farmers to use it in their farms, but it started killing their crops. So they had to then genetically engineer the crops to withstand the Roundup, which now has resulted in 80% of our crops are engineered to withstand Roundup and glyphosate-based herbicides. So this herbicide is very prevalent in our food supply, not just because of GMOs, however. It's also sprayed as a drying agent on non-GMO crops, if these are conventional crops, you know, not organic, but on conventional crops such as wheat, peas, beans, soy, legumes, sugar, many different types of crops as a drying agent. And so it's showing up in the majority of our food supply. And I didn't know this at the time, but I thought, you know, if our kids are eating GMOs, they're likely consuming glyphosate because it's on there. And glyphosate might be showing up in their bodies, and I might be able to have evidence to show that GMOs and glyphosate are harming our children. So I bugged a farmer friend of mine who knew a lot of people in the food cause, and after a year and a half, he finally came back and told me that one of his friends that owned a lab had finally invested in glyphosate testing and was able to test for glyphosate. So our initiative was the first one in America back in December of 2012, and by 2013, and in April of 2014, we were able to release the results that we found, or the lab had found glyphosate in our children's urine, in our tap water, and even in our breast milk, over 3,000 times higher levels than had been found to cause sex hormone changes and liver and kidney damage. So it was appalling and took the food movement and, well, I don't say took, but supported the food movement in a new focus, not just on GMO labeling, but on the amount of pesticides and herbicides in our food supply, particularly glyphosate, which has really opened up the conversation across the country and around the world to reduce agrochemicals and GMOs in our food supply. So many labs now test, and thousands of food samples have now been tested, and 34 different countries restrict or ban the use of glyphosate-based herbicides. Many countries now don't spray glyphosate as a drying agent at all on crops. And so we're happy about the progress. It's taking much too long, but there is progress. It's happening.
We have to focus on that progress in order to stay inspired. Now, like you said, we can avoid GMOs, and more and more people are trying to do that. But we can still get glyphosate in our bodies from places we never thought that they would be. I was just at a diner last week, and normally I like to frequent restaurants that serve organic vegan food. And I happened to have been with a group of people, and this is where they chose. And the only thing that I could get that was at least in the vegan category was oatmeal. But I knew that it would be conventional oatmeal, and I knew that I was getting glyphosate residue, and I just said, I hope it's just very little. But we know it's in there.
Yes.
In Cheerios and all the children's foods.
Yeah, that's the problem. A lot of people don't think about it. Oats, barley, wheat, peas, beans, the white beans. And here's the issue that I love that you brought up vegan, because so many people that eat vegan and vegetarian, and my family members are some of them for sure. We don't realize that it needs to be organic, because if it's not organic, vegans and vegetarians are exposing themselves to the highest levels of glyphosate residues in the entire food supply. And this has been shown from thousands of food tests done in Canada and now in the United States. So those garbanzo beans, that hummus, that wheat in the pita bread, the oatmeal for breakfast, the beans and lentils that you're eating for dinner are all the foods that are going to have the highest levels of glyphosate-based herbicides. Now, the good news is that those oats that you ate may not have had glyphosate, because last year a grain distribution center that receives oats decided to no longer accept oats that were sprayed with glyphosate. And so there is a movement towards not spraying oats with glyphosate. There's also a movement in Canada called Keep It Clean, where the government and the, actually maybe not the government, but the wheat associations are encouraging the wheat growers to not spray wheat with glyphosate as a drying agent, primarily because the consumers in Italy, the Italian grandmas and parents, don't want glyphosate in their pasta. So we're so grateful to them. And so so this just goes to show that consumer purchases do make a difference in what's happening in the food supply. And there are people that are making changes. Also, a barley and grain distributing center in Australia decided to separate the barley and hops that are sprayed with glyphosate versus the ones that are, because the beer manufacturers are calling for barley and hops that are not sprayed with glyphosate. Mm. So there is a shift going, and I'm hoping that within a year or so, when more food testing happens, either by us or by other food companies, that we're going to see less, if not no, glyphosate at all in some of these products like oats and flour and barley and grains. So that's the direction that we want to go in. Whether it's banned or not, we just want it to stop. Right. I mean, we want it banned,
You can mess with the kids' beer. You can mess with the kids' cereal, but don't mess with my beer. Whatever it takes.
It's been found in wine as well. Yeah. So it's very disturbing and sad for us to see that the report that we did finding glyphosate in our children's urine and tap water and breast milk did not get nearly as much media attention as the glyphosate in wine report. That got a lot of attention.
That's so classic. Now, as individuals, can we have our own urine and breast milk tested for glyphosate?
Absolutely, yes. On our website, on Moms Across America, if you click on action, you can see glyphosate testing. And you can go to we mentioned several different labs on there. So you can do that as well. It's under data, get tested for glyphosate under data on momsacrossamerica.org.
That's good to know, everybody. Step right up and get your urine and breast milk tested if you have breast milk. Everybody's got urine, right? Find out where you are.
Act. You can do that. Act. Yeah. Take action, because that's when I went. Our family went 100% organic, I have to say, because before that I thought, a little bit, wheat here and there, it's okay. But when my son, who was about my middle son, my first son had the allergies and he almost died from a nut pecans in the Thanksgiving stuffing. We recovered him by going non-GMO. And then my second son got allergy symptoms at around 8 and a half. And it was at the same time he got autism symptoms. And this was at the same time as when we found glyphosate in his urine, had 8 times higher than was found in anywhere in Europe. He was the first one tested in that initiative. And the doctor found he had gut dysbiosis, C. diff, fungus, all types of bacterial. His behavior was totally erratic. His grades had dropped from A's to D's. He had rashes and was angry and hitting people. And so I realized that glyphosate in the wheat was probably what was contributing to this because he was the only one of my sons that was positive for glyphosate, and he was the only one of my sons that was eating wheat. The other two sons had gluten intolerances. So we eliminated wheat and went 100% organic. And we also eliminated sugar, which during the holidays, which was really hard. But sugar feeds the bad bacteria, right? So you need to eliminate mm-hmm. sugar. And we also did an antifungal and probiotics and colloidal silver and all of that and sauerkraut. And within 6 weeks, we retested him, and his glyphosate levels were no longer detectable, and his autism symptoms were gone and have never come back. And so we're saving tens of thousands just on the autoimmune and the allergy doctor appointments, but hundreds of thousands on the autism symptom therapies that we would normally have to do if my son had continued to have autism symptoms. So,
and he got his life back.
He got his life back, and he's got his life back.
That's the good news.
And social and yeah, and he's able to fulfill on his potential.
You can't put a cost on a price important. On that.
Yeah. Yeah, but it was the test results that, you know, looking me in the face, 8.7 parts per billion in his urine, that was like, wait a second, okay, this is it, 100% organic. That's what we're doing.
You know, you mentioned garbanzo beans, and I think the garbanzo bean is the most amazing food on the planet. You can do so many things with it, and we eat a lot of garbanzo beans in many forms, and the beans that we use, we always buy organic, but I was not buying organic garbanzo bean flour until maybe a year ago. And I flinched because I didn't even know that there was a lot of glyphosate in garbanzo beans. I just felt like I've got to be buying more organic. And I bought this one brand called Namaste, and the quality is just amazing. It's more expensive, but how much more? Mm-hmm. It's not that much more, and we're worth it. Our lives depend on
it. Absolutely. Well, it's actually cheaper to buy organic if you're comparing it to the standard American diet and going out to eat, and also to the doctor's bills. I mean, for instance, just the standard American diet, if you stay at home and chop up organic potatoes and make French fries, you know, baked in the oven with healthy oils, you can save $917 a year just on the servings of French fries twice a week for your family. And that's just, you know, versus eating out, and that's just the fries. You could save thousands of dollars a year just eating home twice a week instead of eating out at a restaurant and eating conventional food. You can also save, as I mentioned earlier, tens of thousands of a year. For instance, we used to spend between $10,000 and $15,000 a year just on the copays with good insurance for my kids' allergy and autoimmune doctor visits, right? They got sick much more often. Now, we haven't been to a sick doctor visit in 3.5 years. There's just been no reason. If they've gotten any type of, you know, fever or cough or cold, they get over it in one day. You know, the doctors usually say wait 24 hours before you go in, you know, to bring them in for symptoms. And we do. We wait, and then we don't have to bring them in because they're getting better. They're recovering. They don't have those types of illnesses for 2 weeks like some of their classmates do. And I attributed this primarily to eating an organic diet and paying attention to the gut microbiome, which means introducing the good probiotic type foods like sauerkraut and kombucha and apple cider vinegar and lots of fiber, lots of whole fruits and vegetables, and of course organic food. That makes all the difference in the world.
I have a batch of organic cashew yogurt incubating in my oven right now. Mm. And it is
wonderful.
It is the most amazing food. It's just cashews and water, and then the probiotics, the bugs from my last yogurt batch. But it's addicting. It's the most delicious thing. We put it on everything.
Wow, that's wonderful. Well, you know, there's a lot of great alternatives out there. We do sourdough bread. You can make a loaf of sourdough bread for $1, and if you're gluten intolerant, not celiacs, but a lot of people would be surprised to know that they can probably digest ancient grains, like mm-hmm. I use Kamut International's ancient grains that are organic and do not have gliadin, which is in the modern wheat. And I'm able to consume that and not, you know, unlike the normal modern day wheat, which can give me rashes and, you know, fatigue and irritability and headaches and all that sort of thing. So there's a lot of alternatives now there that out there that are organic and healthier and less expensive than eating the conventional, you know, diet. And so I'm happy to talk to people who are, you know, finding alternatives and have good tips on, you know, on fermenting food or canning or preserving or, you know, making our own things. I think it's time to go back to the way our grandmas made food. And then the more that we do that, the more that we find out we're just fine.
I totally agree. And I love to say, people, find your kitchen. I know that people are overwhelmed with activities and feel like they don't have the time or the skills. But just like learning how to walk and run, it takes a little time, it takes a little practice, and the benefits are tremendous. And there's and bring the family back, bring your friends around, do things together. It's so much better than reading your phone all day. Get in the kitchen, get off your phone, get in the kitchen.
Yes. My 11-year-old makes the best French bread, just the best. And it's so fun just to cook bread with him together on Sundays. And to make oatmeal bars that I know my family, my kids will grab during, you know, throughout the week, and do a couple of pots of lentils. And, you know, just, it's really, Sundays is my day to make a whole bunch of things just to have them ready in the fridge for my family to take and eat whenever they want. It's so important. And I also want to encourage, you know, just one other, talking about making our own food, I want to encourage new moms to make their own baby food. Mm. There was a new report out just this past, within this month, from the Healthy Babies Bright Future nonprofit. They tested 168 baby foods from across the country, both organic and conventional, and 95% of them were found to be high in heavy metals. One out of four had all four heavy metals in them. And the heavy metals we're talking about are arsenic, lead, cadmium, and mercury. Now, keep in mind that small amounts of these heavy metals are common and can be found in nature. And, you know, are some of them, it's okay for them to be in our body in small amounts. But high levels are very concerning, especially for babies, because a baby's body is not fully developed yet, and they're not able to detoxify the way that an adult is. A lot of people don't know that a baby doesn't even have kneecaps until they're 3 years old. Mm. So how could their
you brought this up. I remember I was living in the south of France in the early 90s, and I don't have children by choice. And I remember being in the south of France and seeing my friends making baby food. They were just pureeing carrots and pureeing vegetables.
Yep.
And it was such a simple thing. And a light bulb went on, like, oh, we don't need to buy these things in little jars. The little jars are ridiculous. Yep. And now they're so often toxic, which is just very sad. Zen Honeycutt, I want to thank you very much for joining me today. And I'm so grateful for your book, Unstoppable, and for creating Moms Across America, and for everything that you're doing for our food system. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Karen. Thank you to all your listeners. It was such a pleasure. Take care.
Okay. Take care. Wow. That was something, wasn't it? Zen Honeycutt, the author of Unstoppable and the founder of Moms Across America. I hope you visit her website, and maybe you'll think about getting some of those tests to see how much glyphosate you've got. Don't you want to know? I do. Okay, let's keep going. This is awesome. I want to bring on my next guest, Colleen Patrick-Goudreau. She has a new book out called The Joyful Vegan, How to Stay Vegan in a World That Wants You to Eat Meat, Dairy, and Eggs. Colleen Patrick-Goudreau's compassionate living philosophy is propelling plant-based eating into the mainstream and forever changing how we regard animals. A recognized expert and thought leader on the culinary, social, ethical, and practical aspects of living compassionately and healthfully, Colleen Patrick-Goudreau is a speaker, cultural commentator, podcaster, and award-winning author of so many books. We've talked about some of them on this program: The Joy of Vegan Baking, Love It, The Vegan Table, Color Me Vegan, Vegan's Daily Companion on Being Vegan, The 30-Day Vegan Challenge, and the book we want to talk about now, The Joyful Vegan, Everything You Need to Stay Vegan in a World That Wants You to Keep Eating Meat, Dairy, and Eggs. And I believe today is the release date. Congratulations, Colleen, and thanks for being here today.
Thanks, Karen. It is the release date. Thank you so much. It's nice to celebrate it with you.
Yes. Woo, everybody. Ah! I'm raising my hand. This is audio you can't see. I'm jumping up and down. Yay. And tell us how wonderful the reception has been of this book so far.
It's been great. You know, I did a podcast series on these 10 stages and that are the center of the book. And, you know, now for probably about 7 years, I've been hearing from people who are just so thrilled to have a name for the experiences that they're going through, because before that they felt alone, they felt crazy, they felt like no one understood them. And so I'm really, really glad for that. And that's what this book does, is it gives people a name for their experiences, but it also helps them not get stuck in these experiences. It gives them solutions and strategies for obviously staying vegan, but staying a joyful vegan and being a good communicator and being able to express your values and not being apologetic and expressing your autonomy while still living among, you know, society. So it's I'm really proud of it, and I'm really hoping that it will help a lot of people.
Well, as someone who's been vegan for over 31 years, I was smiling throughout the book because I think I've heard all of the quotes that you wrote about. And I thought, okay, this is good. It needs to all be in one place. Mm-hmm. So thanks mm-hmm. for putting it there. Let's talk about a few things. Now, my partner Gary and I, we love to cook. We love to have people over and cook. We love to go out and eat food. And I have to admit that very few people invite us over for dinner. Mm. I think they're afraid. mm-hmm. And the whole vegan thing. Some people try, but it's hard. And wanting to be social and be with people, and the reactions we get.
For sure.
It's always been. It's an interesting. It's a sacrifice, in mm-hmm. some ways. Mm-hmm. I mean, I wouldn't do it any other way, and I have so much gratitude, and I'm grateful for the choices I've made. But you have to understand the dynamics when you make choices, and your book helps us understand that. So we know it's not us.
Well, I would say it's both. I would say in the end, all we're responsible for is our own behavior and our own reactions to other people's reactions. I mean, I think what I try to do is help people understand why people react the way they do, and then give them the agency to respond, because that's really it in the end. Now, are there people who are just going to be intimidated and unhappy, and they don't want to deal with us, and they think that everything we do is going to be a judgment of them, and they get defensive and they get hostile? You know, there are some people who just don't want to bother, and it's easier for them to just walk away. But I really think there's so much more going on, and I do think that we have a responsibility as well. I think there are a lot of things that we can do better, and a lot of things that we can do differently, so that we're honing these relationships. And again, some might just walk away. Some might just say, I don't want to deal with it. I don't want to invite you to dinner. I don't want to learn how to cook vegan, even though they're probably already eating vegetables, I hope. and that's going to be the case. But what can we do to take responsibility for these relationships and how we can be better? So, you know, obviously, I think there is a level of intimidation. I think there is also a level of people not understanding, that they really don't know what to cook, even though I do believe that people are cooking, quote unquote, vegan, because they're hopefully cooking with vegetables and fruits and nuts and seeds and beans and mushrooms and grains and things that everybody can eat. They're not just reserved for vegans. But I do think there's an element of they don't want to ask. If they don't know something, they don't want to seem like they don't know something. They don't want to fail. They don't want to do it wrong. They don't want you to judge them. They don't want it to be bad. So they don't want it, you know, you to not feel like they did it right. Not that you're imposing that on them, but are there ways that we can kind of guess what people are, you know, potentially thinking, or why they might be intimidated, and how can we do better? Certainly around the social aspects, certainly around the communication aspects of telling people why we're vegan. There's a lot of presumptions, I think, that we have when we first go to our family members and friends about how they should respond to us, that they should understand why this means so much to us, that they should understand why it is not a comparable, why literally, like you said, it's we wouldn't have it any other way. Have we ever really expressed to our friends and family why this is so serious for us, why it means so much to us, and that it has nothing to do with them, that it's not a comment on them, it's not a judgment of them, that it has everything to do with us? I just wonder if we couldn't do things better to at least say, look, I did my best. I really did try to communicate. I really did try and reach out. Right. I mean, there's just always something we could probably do a little better instead of just saying it's them and I take no part.
Absolutely. I also want to say that we have a lot of friends and family that have been very supportive,
right,
and have right. made some amazing meals. We've been invited to make pizza in someone's pizza oven in their backyard, and they brought Daya cheese and made sure everything, all the pizzas that we were eating were compatible. And, a lot of our family members always make sure there's something for us or invite us to make it. And so there's been, you know, a lot of great support, but, you know, also there's been both. And sure, we can always do better.
Right.
But your book, there's a line in your book that says, let's talk first about how self-acceptance, self-awareness, and self-compassion must be the foundation of our coming out process. And I mean, your book is about being vegan and how to deal with everything that hits us when we make that choice. But it's bigger than that, because a lot of the reactions to what we're experiencing have to do with people in general and their own issues and their own perception of the world and their own self-awareness, their own stuff. It's mm-hmm. big, and we just see it. It just comes out when we say, oh, I'm vegan.
Thank you. That's exactly what this book is. I mean, I could replace being vegan with just doing anything else that's outside of the status quo and that threatens the status quo. This particular topic threatens the status quo more than I think anything else, because it's so integral to our everyday lives, to our relationships, to our histories, to our cultures, to our religion, to our families. I mean, it touches everything, holidays, everything. And so this issue of eating touches every aspect of our lives. But absolutely, the stuff I'm talking about is the stuff of relationships and communication and understanding and compassion. So, and again, I can't help but say it all does begin with us, because how we frame it for ourselves is going to dictate how we frame it to the world. And that's the stuff, that line you quoted is from the chapter Coming Out Vegan, because it is about first getting right, not just getting right, because we all, when we make this transition, when we have this epiphany, when we quote unquote become vegan, we do feel that it's in alignment with our values and that it is the right thing to do and that it does feel right to us. But what I think gets skipped is sitting with that, understanding what that means for us, understanding what that's going to mean for our families and our relationships, and understanding what that's going to mean for us framing it and how we communicate it, so that once we bring it to then our friends and family and coworkers and neighbors, we're really clear. And I think it's that stuff that gets skipped, the personal work, the coming out to ourselves. I've heard vegans say, I don't know what to say when people say, why are you vegan? I literally haven't sat down to find an articulate response that really reflects their truth, their authenticity, and their values in a way that they can really be proud of that without worrying how someone else is going to take it. And that's the stuff I think is really key to then being able to bring it to the right. I say we have to come out privately before we come out socially.
Mm-hmm. I'm definitely inspired by the progress that I've seen over the decades. More places I go to, people know the word vegan. There seem to be more options in places. And I want to look at this as a good thing, but if I go to a social event or a dinner that isn't a vegan event and I walk in the room, everybody knows, oh, the vegan's here. They know me, they're aware of it. And then, you know, that creates some dynamic. And I don't want to put people on the defensive, but they're naturally on the defensive mm-hmm. before we, mm-hmm. just by the presence of a vegan being in the room.
For sure. Yeah, right. Exactly. I do call that the being the vegan in the room.
Vegan in the room.
Because it really is like all you have to do is be there for that to spark a lot of different issues in people, because people, you know, we act as mirrors for each other all the time. Hopefully we do. I mean, hopefully we do. I mean, all of us, not just non-vegans, and vegans are the mirror, but all of us should reflect back to each other what we need to look at, what comes up for us, what we might need to do differently, what we might need to do better, what we're not doing. And so certainly around this issue, because being vegan is such a expression of our values, when a non-vegan encounters a vegan, what naturally happens is they just see it as, again, a kind of a commentary on what they're doing and what they're not doing. So the first thing I would say is, first of all, just know that that's going to happen. And I mean, you're already aware of it. Most people are, because we show up and we can see the reactions people have. But I think the next step is to understand that it has nothing to do with us personally. It has everything to do with what's coming up for the person, you know, who encounters us, and they're working out their own stuff. And what happens is they deflect that discomfort by making jokes, by being hostile, by being passive aggressive, by making quips, by laughing at us, by making light of it, all these ways that they deflect their discomfort. If we can understand that that's what they're doing and that it's not a personal attack on us, it really changes how we see them, and it really changes how we engage with them. And that can change the whole dynamic and the whole conversation. So understanding that, yeah, it is real, but it's not something to take personally. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. For me, my motto is love is the only answer. Just come from a place of love.
Sure. I agree. But sometimes people need that to be broken down a little bit. Like, what does that mean? Yeah.
We might need to have these, or maybe they exist already, these acting out scenarios for vegans.
What do you mean?
Where you act out with people. Okay. You're in a room with people and you all want to know. And so you set up a scene. Okay, you're going to a dinner and you're going to play the non-vegan. You're going to play the vegan. Go. And you can act out the things that are going to happen and kind of find how you manage the conversation. That could be fun.
Practice. I agree. Role playing and practice. I think that's the only way to get good at communicating, for sure.
Yeah. Now, my favorite parts of the book were the stories you told. Humans love stories. We're storytellers, and that's what I love the most. The one about the dove shoot was the most moving. You might talk about that a little bit. It's interesting what humans like to do, but I loved how you handled it and what came out of it and your mantra and the results that you got from how you handled the situation.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it's a story I tell about being confronted with. I mean, it was a dove shoot. I as I say in the book, I really resist calling them hunters, because they were just men who were standing there with guns who were shooting birds out of trees. So there's not a lot of sportsmanship, in my opinion, about that. I had volunteered to be on patrol during this dove shoot over a 2-day period. And it just meant that I was there to just make sure that if doves were shot and they fell over on our side of the property, that we'd be able to tend to those birds if we could. And it also meant just making sure they weren't shooting birds on our side of the property. And so I had, you know, was really scared about how I was going to feel that day. It was just really scary to confront people who I, you know, perceive as very different than me, and whose values I perceived as very different, and to watch birds being shot. I mean, I was scared. And I made a decision about how I was going to respond to it, because I was also afraid of my reaction. I didn't want to stand there and just be angry and judge them and my whole day be just that. And I made the decision because I couldn't stop it. There was no way to stop the shoot. I wasn't going to stop the shoot. And I could have stood there with a placard and, you know, said, "You suck," the whole time. And that wasn't going to do anything either. And so I made the decision to, what I realized what was happening is that there was compassion lacking in the field. And I believe that's the situation in any situation we encounter with people, where if compassion is lacking, then the answer isn't to just withhold compassion. The answer is to fill that space with compassion. And so I made the decision to fill my heart, my mind, my thoughts with compassion, and thus that field that day instead of holding anger. And the shifts that took place in my own mind and my own heart were profound. And I'll never know, but I give some examples of how I really believed that there were shifts in the field that day and in the men's minds, or at least in our interactions with one another. And it was profound. And I've never forgotten that. And I've shared that with folks about how that to me is the foundation of how I interact with people who don't agree with me, who I don't agree with, whose values seem antithetical to mine. And it really is the foundation of my place in this world. And I think there's a lot to glean from it.
We can all learn a lot from that. It's the only way really to come to common ground and communicate, and maybe even everyone gets to a better place. And yes, this isn't just in the vegan, non-vegan world. This is true of all communication. We need to learn this communicating with our families and with our strangers and politics, please.
For sure. Absolutely. Absolutely.
I'm thinking of my moment like that when I spoke to 250 cattle producers when I was on a panel about animal agriculture and climate change. And it was an amazing moment. And I chose, as you did, to come from a space of compassion. And I really worked to find common ground so that they knew we were all in this together. We were all wanting the same things, mm-hmm. really. And it was amazing, the reaction. Amazing.
Yeah, right on.
It was positive.
For sure. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
That's so positive.
That's amazing. It's hard, but it's so worth it.
Okay. At the end of your book, I just have to bring this up because I loved it. You mention the musical Into the Woods. It's one of my favorite musicals. And there's a lot of things I want to say about it. First about me and then about your book. This is my show. It's all about me. that's not true. But I'm a performer. I've performed as Rapunzel and Cinderella in Into the Woods. And just last year, I was a vocal director and conductor of a family theater production of Into the Woods. It's an amazing show with so many great lessons. And I love that you put two of my favorite subjects in the same book, veganism and musical theater. So it was great. But Into the Woods does have some powerful messages. I mean, for example, you talk about the journey and that there is no happily ever after that we learn in this book. I mean, in this story. But there's so much more. So as children, many of us were introduced to Grimm's fairy tales, either the original ones or the watered-down Disney ones. And there's always loss and violence and all kinds of things. And we're encouraged to engage with this. But many parents, for example, just go nuts when you want to share the information about how animals are treated in the industrial farms and talk about slaughtering animals. It just seems so violent. So I'm just kind of interested in that comparison where some violence is okay, especially in fairy tales, but it's not okay when we want to share the truth with children.
Well, sure. Well, to extend the metaphor and to actually use more of the Into the Woods story, one of the conclusions that the characters come to is that all of that stuff that's happening is not happening out there. And I think that is what fairy tales are for parents. They can tell their children about all of this bad stuff that's out there, all of the stuff in the dark woods and all of the monsters out there, and it's safe. But as soon as you have to confront those monsters and that darkness inside of our own lives, inside our own hearts, inside our own minds, inside our own behavior, that's where I don't want to go there. And that is ultimately what the characters come to in the story, is that it actually is that's part of life, is the darkness that we bring to the world. And so that's why parents don't want to confront that, because they're the ones contributing to it. And they're the ones who are bringing it to children, not intentionally, and certainly not to hurt their children, and not to even cause harm to animals, but because that's all they know. And to look at it means having to go through the darkness that is really painful. And it also means, and I think this is the crux of it for me. The reason people avoid it so much is because, not because they know that it's just dark and ugly, but because they know they're going to have to change and they're going to have to do something about it. And change is the most frightening thing for human beings, because we don't know what it is on the other side. We don't know, if we go through the woods, what mm-hmm. is going to be on the other side of it. That is exactly the metaphor. And that's why I love that musical so much. And I mean, I start the book with the "Don't Tell Me I Don't Want to Know" chapter, because that is literally the Sleeping Beauty. It is the Snow White. It's the character who goes to sleep and by spells and luckily is awoken. But just because you wake up doesn't mean you can't go back to sleep again. So that's, I love that metaphor.
Me too. I started this show today dedicating it to activism. And one of the things I love about acting and activism are the first three letters, ACT. Mm. Let's talk about the word ACT, to act, and how we can act to do better.
Well, sure. I mean, sure.
Just the last few minutes as we wrap this up.
Well, I mean, to me, that is the most exciting thing about quote unquote being vegan, which to me is just a manifestation of our values, is that we do have agency and we do have opportunity. That yes, there is a lot of bad in this world and there is darkness and there are monsters, but that's not all there is. And that is to me what's so exciting about making this change, is that just by changing a few things we do on a daily basis, we really can quite literally act on our own values. And then from there, if we want to do more, and that's a lot, like that's a lot already, to go against the status quo and to act in a way and to eat in a way that's different than anybody else, than everybody else, that's a lot. But there's so much more we can do after that. And I think one of the messages that I really hope people take away in the end, in the work that I try to put out in this world, is not that we can make a difference, it's that we do make a difference, that everything we do, everything we buy, everything we eat has an impact on someone or something else. We don't get to decide whether we can make a difference. We get to decide only if the difference we inevitably make is negative or positive. There are no neutral actions. And that's how I feel about that.
And that's where the joy comes, because I want to wrap this up with the idea about being joyful. This is an interesting world we live in, and there's always been darkness, there's always been suffering, there's always been difficulties and challenges, and there's always been light and wonder and beauty. And we can focus on one or the other. We could focus on a little of one and maybe more of the other. It's a choice. And I, like you, Colleen, I choose to be joyful because it feels a lot better. And I think I'm a lot more productive.
Absolutely. What is the point if we don't enjoy it also? Because, and that is exactly what you said, we can choose at any given moment, any given moment, to focus on hope or to focus on despair. That is the joy. That is the joy of, again, having agency, having this life, having the ability to choose. And if we have a couple bad days and we're focusing on the despair, we can change our mind at any time. And that's quite literally why I am a joyful vegan. It's because I choose to be a joyful vegan. It's ours to choose.
Yeah, sometimes it's hard. It's a hard choice sometimes, but in general, it does feel better. Okay, so everyone, you have this book, The Joyful Vegan, How to Stay Vegan in a World That Wants You to Eat Meat, Dairy, and Eggs. It's all there for everything you need. It's the roadmap. Any of the questions, or if you're new at it and you want to know what you're going to be hit with, it's all there with solutions. Thank you for that. And just the last thing. So you're in the Bay Area, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So what's new and delicious for vegans where you are?
Oh, my gosh. I wish there was more. Not going to lie. Just going to say it. I wish there were more. I go to other cities all around the world, and I'm just blown away. And you'd think the San Francisco Bay Area would have more. And we don't have as much as you'd think. And to be honest, a lot of the restaurants that do open are very heavy. Like the vegan restaurants, they're just heavy. I was supposed to go to lunch yesterday with someone, and I just couldn't even think of just a nice place to go for just a salad, to be honest. And so I wish there were more.
I just want to interject here. The one that I miss is Herbivore.
Yes, I don't miss Herbivore. I didn't love Herbivore.
Because I could get a salad there.
I did. It's true. You could get a salad there. Millennium is still my favorite. There's also a new restaurant opening. There's a new vegan Italian restaurant opening. It's in the very early stages, but I'm very excited about it because it's actually taking over the space from a very well-known, long-standing non-vegan restaurant. What's that?
Oh, is that, that's the one on Union Street.
It's Jardiniere was the restaurant that in San Francisco that has been there for a long, 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 long time. And they're closing and a vegan Italian restaurant is opening. I can't remember the name of it. I can't remember. It's a couple who lives in Sonoma County. They also have a farm sanctuary in Sonoma County, and I'm blanking on the name. But if people typed in vegan Italian Jardiniere, they'd be able to find it. Okay. But there's lots opening all the time. I mean, it's very encouraging. But it's happening everywhere. I mean, I'm blown away by the cities that I go to that you wouldn't expect it to have lots of lovely vegan restaurants, and they're popping up all over the place. So I'm definitely encouraged. Absolutely.
Awesome. Thank you for joining me today, Colleen Patrick-Goudreau, and very best of luck to you on your release date today with the newest Joyful Vegan that is available to us. Again, thank you so much.
Thanks, Karen. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. That was everybody, Colleen Patrick-Goudreau, the Joyful Vegan, how to stay vegan in a world that wants you to eat meat, dairy, and eggs. I hope you have enjoyed this program as much as I have. I'm Karen Hartglass. You can find me at responsibleeatingandliving.com. Email me at info@realmeals.org. I always love to hear from you. And everybody, have a delicious week.